Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This is maybe the last talk of the Range Retreat, but not necessarily, because as many of you know, there is a Buddha's allowance to extend the Range Retreat for one more month to keep people from disrobing. I don't think we get away with that. But there's only 5 more days left to enlightenment or bust. But sometimes when we get to the end of things, one has to learn how to deal with the end of things wisely. Too often, when we get close to the end, we make 2 mistakes, which is either just thinking only a few more days left and putting this striving which looks for the future rather than striving which puts the energy in the present moment. And of course, that just screws one up. Or that one just waste time thinking only a few days to go, what does it matter? And both are obviously just dysfunctional ways of meditating, of practicing. It's dysfunctional ways of living a life. So even when we get towards the close of things, whether it's the end of a retreat, whether it's the end of our life, whether it's the end of our stay in a monastery, we should always make sure to value every moment which we have. And not wish away sort of days, months, or even hours or minutes trying to wait for something in the future. As you all know, I've said many times that waiting for things in the future is just what drives life and keeps it going. And you never reach any satisfaction or any rest. It's just always this irritation of going for the next thing. However, I quite like the idea of endings. Because I was taught by Ajahn Chah, and one of the things he always told me, he said that I like endings. And he said, I ordained because I could see no end in lay life. And he said, I could see an end of things in the monastic life. It was a very profound thing which he said, because even though I was still young, I had looked upon that sort of lay life and think it was an endless round of repeat TV shows, an endless round of romance and separation, of relationships, an endless round of going to work on a Monday morning and knocking off on a Friday, an endless round of going to the shopping, doing your whatever else it was going to do. And it was after a while just the boredom of it just really hit me. And I was only sort of in my 20s. It just was totally meaningless. But the worst part of it was not just it was meaningless, but it was going to go on forever. Not just in one life, because I understood even at an early age about reincarnation. And to me it was one of the most obvious facts that sort of life continues on. This is one birth amongst many. And it didn't make sense that just we had one birth. That was just really sort of weird. If you're going to have one, why not 2, 3, 100, and so on. So for me, just the cycles, which I saw, you know, through telescopes in astronomy classes, things going round and round, circulating, never ending. That was how I viewed life. And that's how I viewed many, many things. It was constant going round, 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 round. And I remember just this movie which I saw as a young man. It was Dracula. I think I mentioned it before because, listen, if you've listened to my talks, there's only a certain amount of movies I've watched in my life. And, you know, you've got to keep quoting them again and again. But this was Dracula for the thinking man. And this poor Dracula, he was immortal. He would keep on living forever. Except if he could manage to get lured out into the sunshine, because he could only come out at night, the sunshine would kill his immortality and he would die. And for year after year, decade after decade, about 4 or 5 centuries, he'd been living like this. And the whole movie was about, even though he was afraid of death, he was more afraid of living. The boredom of, you know, 4 or 5 centuries, you know, sucking blood from virgins' necks, you know, been there, done that. And after a while, you know, what else do you want in life? And this is what happens with the sort of the endlessness of the round of samsara. And so in the end, the end part of the move, he let himself willingly be drawn out into the rising sun. Because even though he was afraid of death, he just couldn't stand the endlessness of existence any longer. And for me, that was actually a profound, it's a very wonderful Dharma point in that. And it's one of the things which made me become a monk. Because, you know, I was not sort of a loser in life by any means. Great education, reasonably popular with my friends and colleagues. In just a couple of weeks when I go to UK, just meeting many of those friends again, just still keep in touch. But it was just the fact that in the future, as I looked at it, okay, you know, you get a job, you get a house, you get married, you get divorced, you have kids, they mess around, they drive you crazy. And then when you get rid of them finally, then they have kids and then you're stuck with their grandchildren. You know, this is why the Buddha called it Rahula. I was very fortunate that sort of the girlfriends never did conceive. Some of the things made me a bit worried, but I was very fortunate to be out of that. And sometimes it was just the sheer endlessness of it worried me. And even actually that was one of the reasons why I left academia. Because there was no end of examinations. Okay, you get your sort of your bachelor's, then you get your master's, then you get your PhD, and then you do another course and another certificate. And I saw other people, they were just endlessly doing this. I remember one of my friends from school, Tim King, you know, he went to King's College in London. And he used to write on his lab coat, King of Kings, as his joke, because his name was King. You know, King of Kings is epithet for Jesus, if you didn't know that. But anyhow, you met up with him a few years after, you know, after we left school, and he was still doing more and more courses, more and more degrees. And I thought, gee, doesn't he get fed up with that? He was just so highly qualified. And it was just an endless of more qualifications. And I thought, that's not the way I wanted to live a life. Just maybe like Ajahn Chah, you just see the ennui. The ennui, this French word, means this deep sense of boredom. What might be a very good translation of the word we just chanted a few minutes ago, nibbida. This sense of when you look at this, say, just, it sucks. What do I want to keep on doing this for? This just makes no sense at all. And that nibbida just wanted to put an end to things. And that's actually one of the reasons why I became a monk. And it's certainly what drove Ajahn Chah to live his life as a monk, to put an end to things. I know that most people in life, they celebrate beginnings, they celebrate births, and they weep at deaths. And they always say they get it the wrong way around. I've often noted that when they bring the babies to see you, the baby cries and cries and cries. But when you go to see a corpse, it's always smiling. The corpse knows best. The baby knows best. It's starting a whole life. Oh, not again. And that beginnings are suffering. But apparently we love beginnings. Beginning anew, starting anew. A new practice, a new retreat, a new place to stay, a new monastery, a new life. Because that has this stupidity of hope, thinking this time it will be better. The next retreat, now yeah, I've learned a lot about this one, the next retreat will be the real one. The next sort of dana, the next pie which I eat will be the delicious one. Whatever it is, we always look for this next experience and thinking that will be the one. In life it's the next relationship, the next job, the next season of your football team, whatever it is. Always looking for the next. Always looking for beginnings and celebrating beginnings. But if you use your intelligence and your wisdom, your experience, beginnings are the ones which really lead to suffering. I can't forget one of Ajahn Sumedho's stories, because he went to go visit his home after many years in Thailand, and when he came back he told us all these stories. He said he met one of his childhood friends, a girl, and asked her how she was, and she said, "Oh, I'm very glad you've come at this time, because I'm getting married next week. Can you come?" And he said, Ajahn Sumedho said, "I thought you already were married." He said, "Oh, yeah, this is number 7. Or something like that, a big number. I can't remember exactly. My memory's not the best at 58. That's ending now. But anyway, and Ajahn Sumedho, I said, "What? 7 marriages? Why do you do that?" And she gave this very profound answer, which is why Ajahn Sumedho told him, "Why you remember these things? You remember these stories, not because they're just material for your next talks, because there's something deep inside of this." She said, "Look, I love the romance. That's wonderful. Falling in love, meeting someone, courting. I love planning the marriage. I love the ceremony with all your friends and all the crying and the tears and the handkerchiefs. I love all that. But what comes afterwards, I hate. So then I stop, get divorced and start again." That's what she was into doing. Just finding a nice boy, courting, falling in love, getting engaged, planning the marriage, and then once the marriage was over, the next couple of days, divorcing and starting all over. Because she said that was a nice part. At least she was honest. And she had no fantasies about what happens afterwards. It's not just all happy, we live happily ever after. And that sort of idea of like beginnings, people thinking that that's going to be the beauty. After a while, you suss that out, you investigate that, and the beginnings of things are just more problems. That's why that sometimes when we begin a new project, let's begin a new retreat center, let's begin a new monastery, let's begin a monastery down south, up north, out east, west, I don't care where you are, it's just more suffering when you begin something new. As for me, I just want to end things. End my involvement in the retreat center. Set it up and drop it and let it for someone else to look after it. End my involvement in this monastery even. That's why I love going back to my room and getting into my cave, because that's where things end, at the door to that cave. Because I love endings, because endings means peace, means freedom, means every time you write a letter and you've finished it, you feel so good that it's finished, it's done with, you can throw it away. The only thing is that the next day some more letters come in the post. It's wonderful to have ending. And now, of course, you've learned how to do emails, but I tell you, my favourite button on that computer is the delete button. I love that button. Because that is like ending things, finishing things, sending them to sort of this cyber cessation. Nibbana-ing all your old emails or all this other stuff. Because that ending of things is where I found lots of freedom. I did find a lot of sense of freedom when I ended my education. I still remember when I was a school teacher and I ended my job. You felt a great sense of freedom and space, that all that work was over. And when you became a monk, yeah, it was a beginning. But it was the beginning, it was a path which did have an ending, a real ending. All the other things which I did in life were endless. Always going around and around and around, circling just like the satellite, carrying on like Dracula, always there, always continuing with no end in sight. So the idea of celebrating ends, I think, is a powerful perception, which is why the end of a range retreat is the most powerful time. I've mentioned this to many people, that when I've gone on the pilgrimages to India, many people feel that the centre of Buddhism is Bodh Gaya, just where the enlightenment happened. But I say, no, the centre is Kusinara, where the ending happened. The Parinibbana, that is more important to me than Bodh Gaya. Because Bodh Gaya was just the cause had finished. The momentum, the gas had run out, but the car was still trundling along under its previous momentum for another 45 years. and at Kusinara, just where the Buddha lay down and where all the khandhas ceased without remainder. That was where the magnificent moment occurred. A lot of people don't understand that because they don't value endings as much as beginnings. And when I see things like that, when I value endings more than beginnings, it changes just the whole way you deal with life, the whole way that you deal with your meditation and with wisdom, because you're not there to start new things. It's one of the reasons, having understood that endings is the path to freedom, not beginnings, that you had this rule in the monastery: if anybody has an idea, then why don't we do this? Great, you do it. Which is trying to stop, you know, people having more projects and new things to do. Because more projects, new things, we just become like spiders creating ever more tangled webs, like octopi, I suppose you call them, I don't know. Just going further outwards, entangling the papancha of always starting something new. And it's hard, and I haven't been very successful, especially with like committees, always trying new things, because that's the way of the world. A new family camp, and more retreats, do something different, more talks, a different centre or whatever. You try to limit that if you possibly can, and try and have less things, not more. And trying to have things with an ending rather than things which are going to go on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. That's actually one of the reasons, one of my main aims when I became a teacher here, was to create more teachers to take my place. I haven't been that successful in that. So I can retire, so I can end it. However, you realize that it's more difficult than you ever imagined to create other monks. But at least you can end your own existence. Why is it that people don't like endings? And the fear of endings, whether it's death, whether it's retirement, whether it's the end of a rains retreat. Why is it that we always love beginnings? And this brings me on to one of the other subjects for this talk, which was requested. It's because of this very deep defilement of the craving to be, this attachment to existence, this valuing sort of samsara, and this craving to exist, to be, means that one is going to always be creating. And creating is new things. Creation means beginnings. Cessation means endings. It's no mistake, or it's no small thing that many religions worship creation, and Buddhism worships endings, cessations. Many of the religions pay so much attention to their myth of how this world began. Buddhism focuses on nibbana, the cessation, the ending of things. And to many people who are world affirmers, who love beginnings, who love creating and creation, the whole idea of celebrating cessation, celebrating endings, is actually beyond their imagination even. They can't understand or get their heads around it. But if you live long in life and had experiences and have understood those experiences, if you can remember a few even past lives. I remember reading this article of this lady in Thailand who did have spontaneous recall of her past. And she was just an ordinary girl. She was working in an office, quite attractive, but she said no way would she ever get married. She said, what was the point? So she'd been there and done that before, she remembered it. And even the most wonderful relationship comes to that tragic ending of separation and death. And she'd had that. And so she was saying, in this life, no way in the world will I get married. I don't want to begin something which is going to cause suffering at the end. So I was very taken by that little sort of article, as I'm taken by anyone who realizes that the purpose of life is to celebrate the endings. Someone reminded me last week of that simile which I gave in the Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond book, of that machine which was made in California. And I know these talks I go out to other people. If anyone goes to a junk shop in San Francisco or Los Angeles and finds one of these machines, because apparently they were popular, so monks who were alive at that time told me, a machine, a box, a metal box with just one switch on the side or on the front. And people would come and you put it on your coffee table and say, what is that? They turn the switch on and find out. It's battery operated. Turn the switch on and motor would start and wheels would turn and a flap would open up at the side and a mechanical arm would come out from that hole, go around the front and turn off the switch and go back again. And that was its whole meaning and purpose in life. And that was really, you know, cool at that time. People loved that because it was making a statement. And that was actually thought, wow, whoever invented that had a good idea of what Nibbana is all about and what the meaning of life is. The meaning of life is not to create more beginnings, but to create endings. And when you look at it, isn't that something of what you really understand? You want to finish things. Those of you looking forward to the end of the retreat want to finish it. Put it away. Have done with it. Those of you who are writing articles or translating books or editing books, isn't it the case you want to finish it, end it, so you're free? Those of you who are going to go somewhere else when this retreat finishes, sometimes you're already planning and packing. Why is that? Because you want to finish it. That idea to finish it, where is that coming from, that craving to finish? It is because you realize just the suffering of things and you want to put it aside so you can be free. When the work, when the business, when the task is completed, it promises this freedom. And that promise of freedom, that promise to rest, that promise of contentment, that is the force which will eventually, whether you like it or not, take you to both jhana and enlightenment. We want to have some peace, some freedom. It's that type of happiness which will eventually drive your process of five khandhas. You want to be free. And of course, that urge to be free has created many political systems where there's been no freedom after all. Promising much, but delivering little. It's created social systems like capitalism and Marxism, which have promised freedom, but those within those systems realize there's no real freedom there. It's promised, it's created romance and love to be free, you know, from this having to sort of search for your soulmate and partner, finally finding them, and then I'll be happy. All of this time it's like being free from an irritation, being free from a burden, being free from an affliction, the Buddha said. And it's that quest to be free from afflictions which is driving the world. It's not so much a craving for some hope, for some pleasure, for some goal, but it's being free from this affliction, this heaviness, this burden of life. This is what drives people. If you think of this monastery or meditation as a burden, then you want to leave. If you think that what drives you, on a Friday you can see these guys, well, it's not Friday yet, they're working down on the patio this morning. Their drive to be free so they can finish off and go home. That's what was driving them to work. All the drive to end the burden. When you were working in the kitchen this morning, you Anagarikas and visitors, cleaning up, doing the monthly clean-up, you wanted to get it finished. as they say, to get it out of the way. You find that's what most of life is, trying to get things out of the way. Trouble is, if you get some things out of the way, you just create more things. But there's some things when you get them out of the way, new things don't turn up. And those are the path of the Dhamma. To get things out of the way, like defilement, like hindrances, like craving. Those are the things which when you get out of the way, when they end, they truly end things. They don't create more things. So that urge, the urge to be free, the urge to end afflictions, is the path. But our problem is that we don't know what an affliction is. And so we throw away the beautiful and carry around the ugly. We keep tying ourselves up when there's the opportunity to be free. We keep putting ourselves in prisons when the doors are always open for us. That is our stupidity. You look at yourself and how many prisons you put yourself in so far in your life. No one else forced you into those cravings and the prisons of the attachments, which are your prisons. When we talk about attachments, you can understand these are sort of burdens. And why do you carry those things around? After coming across Buddhism, I couldn't imagine sort of having a girlfriend or a partner again. Why would you have 5 khandhas is enough? Why do you want 10 khandhas to worry about? And then after you have 10 khandhas, you have 5 little khandhas come later. And you have the patter of little khandhas around your house. It is absolutely crazy and madness when you really think about it. And you can't even handle your own 5 khandhas and your old concerns and worries. One body is enough to look after, rather than having to worry about all these others. And it was wonderful just to have that sense of walking away. Actually, that was probably the relationship I had was closest to getting entangled. I remember when it fell apart, walking away and feeling no sadness. I remember I was quite surprised at myself that there you were attached to that girl, and when it all fell apart, you walked away. I was hitchhiking back to Cambridge, and I felt so free, which was surprising. Of course, now as a monk, you know why you felt free. Wow, I don't have to worry about that girl anymore. I don't have to be concerned about performance and dressing up or whatever else. You felt so free. And that actually, that sense of freedom from the attachments, from the stickiness of life, free of having to worry about finances, having a, there's only a sort of a rented house, freedom of having to worry about my motorbike, giving it away. I was giving away burdens and attachments and afflictions. You went off to become a monk and it was wonderful when you didn't have any so many attachments. You had ended things. And it's great even to end just your attachment to your family as well. Because your family is also a burden. You're supposed to look after them. But I'm being quite honest that I don't have affection for my family. You let that go a long time ago. You do your duties. You try and be a member which doesn't offend them or affect them. But basically that's gone. If my mother died tonight, I would feel probably nothing. Just the end. The end of another sort of contact, that's all. I'm not sort of exaggerating that. Because you have ended things. And when you end things like that, you feel a great sense of freedom. So how tied up are you? How entangled are you in life? And is that really where you want to be and what you want to be and how you want to be? And there is a path which leads to the end of entanglements, the laying down of burdens, the freedom of the mind. And that is that path of the Eightfold Path. Starting off, has to always start off with right view, to understand an affliction from a freedom. And again, many people don't understand that. They feel that you guys who come and spend your 3 months in a monastery where you can't do this and you can't do that, well, why aren't you going to be free? Leave the monastery and you're free. But people have done that, have told me that they feel so tight and entangled now. And when they come to a monastery, they feel so free. People do that when they say they're on retreat. Just the people on retreat over the road at Jhana Grove, they're enjoying it because they feel this great sense of space and freedom. Certainly that's what I felt. And that's where you discovered those two different types of freedom. What I call the freedom from desires, or the freedom of desires. Freedom of desires is when cravings and desires, they pull you around, just like people used to pull around the water buffalo, put a ring through their nose and pull them this way and pull them that way. Desires are just like a leash and you're the dog being dragged around and told what to do. Please remember that those desires and cravings, they're not under your control. They just come up. You've lived as a monk here, you lived as an anagarika, you lived as a layman, laywoman. You notice those desires and cravings, they come up. And sometimes they don't come from you. So where did that one come from? I don't want that, but there it is. So don't ever think that these are generated by you, that they're my desires. They come from causes and effects. They're totally independent, separate from you. And they are your enemy. Just to recognizing these cravings as an enemy of freedom, not as a provider of freedom, is a wonderful place to start your practice. It's a right view. But when anybody has a wrong view and they think that their cravings and their desires are going to provide them and that their cravings are under your control, then you're just asking for a lot of suffering in life. I don't know how many good people, they do have relationships, and they cheat on those relationships. They even commit to a partner, and then they see someone else, and they just can't help themselves. And these are good people who commit adultery. Why is that? Because craving is just so hard. You know that because you've been in a monastery for long enough. Just how hard is it for you to subdue your craving? So what's it going to be like out there in the world? Don't think and be arrogant that you're in control and you have power over these things. They have power over you. That's why anyone who lives with craving, with desires, has no freedom at all. You see, the intense form of that craving, when people have addictions, whether it's addiction to drink, to drugs, addiction to food, addiction to dysfunctional behavior, and they just can't stop themselves, even though they know it's wrong. You have people who smoke cigarettes, even though they know it's going to cause them cancer, they know that. You just can't stop. You're under the power of craving. You're not free at all. That's also why when I gave up things as a layman, when I gave up alcohol, it was a tough thing to do. But I felt so free afterwards. And it wasn't as if I was putting myself in a jail. I was getting out of jail when I decided, no, I'm not going to drink anymore. I was free of the craving for that drink. I was free of the craving for sex. I was free of the craving to be popular. All of these desires you'd actually let go of. He said, it's a great sense of freedom. And maybe that was one of the reasons also why I became a monk and stayed as a monk, because you recognize that this was the path of freedom. And following desires and cultivating desires, making them stronger, was just going to lead just to more imprisonment. And as soon as you let go of things, when they end, you understand what freedom means. It is a freedom from desires. So when you don't follow them, as a couple of people have been talking to me about the plastic brain, when you cultivate and follow desires, you just wire the brain to have more desires. When you resist and say no, remember that's the right effort which I keep encouraging here, the effort to stop, the effort to resist, the effort to relinquish, the effort to say no. That type of effort rewires your brain to resist craving, to be the real warrior who can take the blows of craving and don't flinch and don't follow it until craving is weakened, until you are more powerful than the craving, or rather the Dhamma is more powerful than the craving. You're totally free then. Which means you can see a beautiful girl, you can see beautiful food, you can take it, you can leave it. The craving is easy to say no to. Sometimes, after a while, it doesn't come up at all. And when you don't want anything, it means you don't need anything. And when you don't need anything, you can be content. You've ended something. So one of the things we have to learn how to end is our craving, our wanting. And you know that it's ended because then you have the freedom. It's another affliction. Craving is an affliction, should be looked upon as that. It's like having eczema. I remember just having this ringworm. Don't know where I got it from, but actually when I first came to Australia, you know, on your testicles. And just, it was just so much fun to scratch it for 1 minute, and then it hurt like hell. And it was a really weird thing, because it was just, scratching was incredibly sensual. But then afterwards, it really was painful. And it was, that's such a great simile for sort of craving and lust and desire. Just, you know, you wanted a scratch and it felt so good, but then afterwards, ooh, that was painful, that burning. And after a while, you just resisted the urge to scratch. And after a while, just the thing went away. And I was free from the urge to do this. Many people are not even free from fear. And fear and anxiety, it just imprisons you. And after a while you want to have an end to all of that. And I've mentioned before, this fear, this anxiety, where does it come from? It's all that we think we're going to lose something. We're anxious. Why are we anxious? Why are we afraid? Because we think something important is being taken away from us. It's all this possessiveness, a sense of a self. The function of me is to own things. That's what a self does. That's why people have property. And they feel good about owning things. Their own things. That's why it's tough being a monk where we have communal property. You don't really own it and you can't do what you want with what you have. You have all these rules and regulations of how you're supposed to wear your robes and put them on the line and everything else. And it's, what are you talking about? It's my robe. I can do what I want with it. You can't even do what you want with your own bowl. Which shows you just how little you really own as a monk. And that diminishes your sense of self. But that gives you so much freedom. As most of you have been monks a long time would have realized, you feel far more free the closer you keep your precepts. The more rules you follow, the more free you feel. So people feel, that's weird. When you have rules and regulations, that must be so constricting. You must feel like you're in a prison. Always having to worry about breaking a precept, a pajitya or a dukkata every moment when you're a monk. But of course you don't feel like that. Because those precepts are there to free you from craving. They lessen the will. They end that affliction. And after a while of keeping those precepts, your will, your desires are just so weakened that when it comes to time to sit cross-legged, it's easier to take the next step and weaken them that bit more to get into deep meditation. If you really want to get some good meditation, some strong on a great foundation, you really do have to keep precepts. Their job is to weaken the power of craving enough so you can take that next step and get into jhanas or whatever. And you feel so free. And of course, if you ever do get into deep meditation, even small deep meditations, why is it so delightful? It's always because things have ended, especially thinking ending. Notice, again, this visitor came today, one of Lisa's friends, who said, "Oh, you can't stop thinking." And this whole idea that you can't stop thinking means that these people have been in that prison of thought all their lives and they just don't know anything else. It's like they've been born and bred and grown up in Alcatraz or St. Quentin. They just don't even realize there's a world outside there, a world of freedom. Thoughts do constrict you. They are a prison. And there are times, and each one of you have had those times when you become silent and, oh, you're free. Free of this burden. Because you know what happens? One thought leads to another thought. That's why there are a chain of thoughts. It's like chain smoking. You put one down, you have to pick up another and light it. That's what thoughts are like. They're endless. And they can drive you crazy. They can stop you sleeping at night. Even though you're tired, the thoughts and the worries continue. The thoughts can make you just so upset as you think about what somebody said and why they said it and how unfair and cruel and heartless and stupid that was. And those thoughts can make you angry at good people. And those thoughts can even drive you insane. I just remember just one experience among many in my time in Thailand. There was one of the great disciples of Wat Nanachai in the days when it was Wat Bar America Wat. That was the first name of Wat Nanachat. It was even emblazoned on the cushion they gave Ajahn Sumedho in Thailand, first year. And this captain in the Thai army, he would come, he was going crazy, and he would walk with us on arms round, and he couldn't stop talking. And it got worse and worse over 2 or 3 days, and I witnessed it. His thinking was getting more fast and more powerful. He just couldn't stop it. And eventually he had to be committed to the hospital. And just that power of thought was putting him in a cage. And the cage was getting more and more small. He had less and less freedom until eventually he broke and went mad. And I can see from that time, as a person who had gone so far with thinking, gone to a great university, where my thinking had been praised, and I've got many, many prizes for how well I could think mathematically, I realized that that was just another prison I was in. And just having the great good fortune to meet a good meditation teacher and get some silence, wow, free from such a really heavy burden and affliction. It's just like sometimes you have hay fever, and hay fever bad, and you get in an aircraft, and after a few minutes, because of their pollen filters and bottled air, you can breathe again. Oh, what freedom. Or sometimes you have a really bad headache or stomach ache, and you take an aspirin or something, and oh, you're free. Or sometimes you have to, your bladder is full, and it's pressing down, you just can't wait to get to the toilet. Ah, oh, free. Freedom from afflictions is contentment, the ending of things. Which is why when you understand what is really worth ending, then every time you see an affliction like thinking or like craving, you realize this is the path to liberation. So you look not to begin new things, but to end things. You look when you're in your hut, not what more you can do, but how you can put that aside and end it. You look at just all this coming and going, traveling here and traveling there. For what reason? Have you got an invitation? Are you actually going to do something useful for others? And in the end, it's an end of all of that. And when you can put an end to everything, then you understand what freedom truly is. You put an end to the five senses in jhana, and that's freedom. You put an end to the will, finally, in second jhana. Those are powerful, powerful experiences. When you do taste freedom, they always say that, you know, Buddhism, the Dharma, is a taste of freedom, a taste of liberation. All Dhammas have that same taste, the taste of freedom, says the Buddha, Vimutti Rasa. It's a beautiful saying of the Buddha, because by the little experiences which you have every now and again, the best experiences of your life, why are they just so cherished? Why are they the best experience? Because they're free. And that freedom is an ending of existence as you knew it. It's a ceasing. And its craving to be is its opposite. Always creating more things, making more things, doing more things. And it's so sad how people complicate their lives and make these prisons, just tying themselves up with their own rope and just complaining why they can't feel free. Good Buddhist monasteries are the places where you can be free. You have afternoons and evenings, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, nearly all day to be free. You don't have morning and evening chanting. Remember, Il-sung was telling me that this is a rare monastery where you don't have morning and evening chanting. Even in Theravada there's very few monasteries. But in Ajahn Mun's tradition, when I went to see his monasteries, they never had chanting. It was only Ajahn Chah instituted the chanting morning and evening. It really wasn't part of the forest tradition. Not the ones in northeast Thailand anyway. So you were free, and that gave you this great sense of peace to end things. And then, when you go back to your rooms or in your cave or wherever you sit, you don't sort of carry on, you know, with your experiences of the day, mulling over them, working on them out, thinking what you're going to do with them, or what you're going to say, and how you're going to organize your day tomorrow. Please end all of that. Time. Find an ending of time. Let it cease. Because time is another burden, it's an affliction. And of course, the way you can end time is just by focusing in the present moment, in the now. Again, the present moment, this tiny dot sort of pressed on both sides, one side by the past, one side by the future, squashed to an infinitesimal point called now. You think that that must be just so hard to stay there, but of course you all know in this present moment there's all this freedom. At last you are free from the affliction of having to think and worry about what's going to happen next. At last you're free from the burden of what's happened to you and the past. So I don't know how many people just weigh themselves down with who said what to who and why and what happened to you. And please let that go. Do you really want freedom? Then you have to be free of time. Be free of thought. Be free of will. End these things. And when you end these afflictions, you'll know what it means, you know, to end everything, to end life, to end samsara. And every time you go deep into these endings, every time you do end the time and you feel it and it's right throughout and it's solid and it's stable, it just feels so amazingly wonderful. It's a taste of freedom. every time when you can, just say, watch the breath, and just got the breath and the other senses have disappeared. You're not thinking. Oh, just how free that feels. It's peaceful, it's beautiful. And every time you can sort of end the five senses, and this body which is aching and irritating and painful and just never, is never comfortable, which is why you have to scratch and move. When you're free of this body, oh, that's bliss. This body is a pain and an ache. When I go to sleep at night, I don't know how many times at night I have to turn over. Doesn't matter how thick. Because sometimes when we go to these gigs overseas, they put you up in these hotels, and those beds, they've got such thick mattresses, but still you have to turn over. Why? Because this body, just no way will it ever give you rest unless you can get into these deep meditation states. As always, if you get rid of your hay fever, if you get rid of your cold, if you get rid of your backache, if you get rid of this and get rid of your stomach ache, there'll always be something else coming up next. This body and its irritations are endless, except when you just drop the body in meditation. It's the only way you find any freedom. And it's a taste of freedom. And these little tastes of freedoms which you get along the path is what the indicators. You join a monastery and you're free from many of the burdens of lay life. Unfortunately, if you stay here too long, you forget that. You're free from all these irritations and burdens. And then after a while, you become free from the worst part of craving by keeping precepts. After a while, you're free from time, free from thinking, free from the senses. Here in jhana, beautiful taste of freedom. But of course, that just encourages you to end even more, and free from even consciousness. Being totally free. You are ending things. And it's an end which doesn't have arising. Too much of life, you see the rise, you see the fall. As soon as it falls and disappears, it rises again. This is endless waves, the endlessness of an ocean rising and falling. But this is where it falls and never rises again. Those are the endings which Ajahn Chah was talking about. So when we come to the end of a range retreat, it will rise again. It's no real end. The practice continues. But go to the real endings, the endings deep inside, where you end attachments, when you end cravings. End them once and for all, if you possibly can. And you find that it's the endings which you'll start to worship and value. And beginnings you'll get so much nibbada towards. You don't want to begin anything more. You want to end things. An ending is the path of the Buddha. Beginnings are the path of the Christians, Muslims, Hindus, those who believe and worship creation. New life. They've even got church like that, Creation New Life Church. I call it Creation New Life Dukkha. More of the same. So you have your choice. What you want, freedom or imprisonment. More beginnings, more trouble, more work, or ending. Take your choice. That's the talk for tonight.
Pano, Bhagavad.